Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey, listeners, Becky here. A quick note before we start. We recorded this episode before the passing of Ivan Reitman on February 22nd, 2022, which is why we don't mention it. We're sorry for his loss, but we are grateful that he left behind so many movies for us to enjoy. As always, thank you for listening, and on with the show. A lot can happen in a year. Trends, debuts, world-altering events, and pop culture and film is there to reflect it all back to us generations down the line. Welcome to the A Year in Film podcast, presented by Hollywood Suite. I'm your host, Becky Shrimpton, and today I'm joined by film and content specialist Cam Maitland and curator and film historian Alicia Fletcher. Welcome to season four of A Year in Film, and boy, oh boy, is this going to be a doozy. Now, this year, we really struggled to narrow down the list of movies for the years we wanted to talk about. Discussions were cordial, but don't think they weren't intense and that we can't wait to share our favorite movies and honestly fantastic guests for 1973, 1985, 1999, and 2010. But let's start at the very beginning, like you do. Today, we're going to look at two movies in a genre that would have made money no matter what. Exploitation. But before we get into those, let's talk about movie trends in general in 1973. You can look at any year like a turning point for something, but like this year has got some serious turning points in them.
Sure. Yeah. I think it's a big year for like blaxploitation, for instance. It didn't start this year, but this is kind of the year where it goes totally, it explodes, arguably maybe drives itself into the ground by producing so many movies.
I mean, this is the year of The Exorcist, right?
Oh, sure, yeah.
Yeah, it's The Exorcist, but like it's where horror and pornography collide in this, you know, very wet yes. dream for a lot of exhibitors where you could theoretically go see a legitimate X-rated film in a kind of high profile.
Yeah,
movie.
Yeah.
A lot of
yeah.
those same movie theaters were playing blaxploitation too.
Yeah.
But
and I actually had this conversation about porn with my partner because he was like, oh, yeah, I know it started with Debbie Does Dallas. And I was like, no, my friend, that is 78. And I know because of the television show.
Yeah.
Deep Throat. I mean, certainly one of the films that we talk about today. It's iconic for porn.
Yeah,
and we're going to talk about it on the podcast. We're going to have a porn expert.
Yeah, we are. It's also like, I think, which what we're going to be talking about today, there's the like European exploitation that is like flowing over stuff like Jess Franco, which I think inspired a lot of our first movie. It's just like, or like I'm Curious Yellow, you know, those kinds of weird movies that we're also playing, you know, as regularly in a way. It's almost like a boom of, yeah. Weird. I mean, there's so many
mysteries
weird
of the organism, which we talked about in season 3, 1971. That's definitely a big one.
It's weird that you could have a Scream, Blackula, Scream, Mysteries of the Organism to like double bill, probably at some weird 42nd Street theater or something. It's also just like erotic. I mean, Last Tango in Paris is this year. It's a huge year, weirdly, which I think we'll touch on a little bit, but for the concept of foreign film because of Last Tango in Paris. The Harder They Come didn't come out in America yet, but it was in Jamaica and it became this huge sensation. And Hong Kong, I actually read a very interesting article about how movies that you don't think of, like, I mean, it's the year of Enter the Dragon, but there was a week where the films Fist of Fury, Deep Thrust, and The Hand of Death were all in the top five of the box office, which made people be like, what? Because, there were just, like, poorly dubbed Hong Kong movies.
We're definitely getting out of the nihilism of 71. Like 71, there's so many extremely dark, extremely bleak movies. And here people seem to be having more fun. Like, I mean, the number one at the box office and like the big Oscar winner was The Sting. And that movie's just goofy and super fun.
Sure. But I mean, corruption still, right? Like that's everywhere. Yeah, everywhere is like, yeah, people are fighting against a bad boss. Like, I mean, it's all these dystopias too. Westworld, Soylent Green. Like it's, but you,
Soylent Green takes place in 2022.
Oh, be careful what you eat. I guess.
Think about that when you eat dinner
tonight. Mark.
Every year, there's always exciting to see who's going to be debuting, and you know, today the names Eugene Levy, Andrea Martin, and Ivan Reitman probably ring some bells. But in 1973, they were far from the household names that we all know. In fact, far from the renowned comedy director producer we know him as today. By 1973, Ivan Reitman, Slovak-born Canadian, had faced deportation once already for the filthy movies he'd made because of Canada's stringent obscenity laws, and he would do so again when it came to Cronenberg's Shivers in 75. Between these two cataclysms, though, Reitman held fast in his cinematic approach to films, which was very much make 'em fast, make 'em cheap, make 'em violent, and for 1973's Cannibal Girls, take a page out of William Castle's big book of gimmicks. Cannibal Girls. Let's get into it. Now, this is one I feel like people are very divided on because some people do call it a hidden gem and other people are like, oh, boy. Yeah. And it's also some people are like, it's a spoof. And other people are like, no, it's not. And I'm on the no, it's not train.
Do you think the people who call it a hidden gem, do you think they've actually seen it?
I think they get
excited by who's in the cast.
Yeah. And it has that shaggy sort of feel. I also feel like when you're talking about kind of outsider horror, it's better than a lot of those. So
true.
Maybe.
True.
Like if we sat through all of the 1970 whatever. I don't know. I think that I'm going to say that both of the films this week are not necessarily my favorite, but I think that they're like watchable oddities.
I think when you look at the budget, like this might be the episode where we talk about the two cheapest films ever on our podcast, because Cannibal Girls was made for $9,000. And I don't have an idea of whether that was Canadian or American.
That was Canadian, from my understanding.
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, that's ridiculous. And then the film we're going to talk about later, Flesh for Frankenstein, is $300,000, which is gargantuan in comparison to Cannibal Girls, but still very minuscule in terms of a budget for 1973. Yeah. So when you think about it in that kind of term, it's sort of amazing, actually. Like the fact that Cannibal Girls was made for $9,000 Canadian, which it looks like
also,
that, is amazing.
A lot of threats.
For
$9,000, a lot of threats, a lot of cajoling. And part of that, too, was travel, because they went to Cannes for this one. But before we get into all of that, Cannibal Girls, who wants the plot?
I'll do it. I'll let Alicia talk about the fancier one.
The classier one?
I guess. Depends on your definition of classy. Cannibal Girls follows, there's eventually kind of a nesting doll structure, but it's essentially about a couple traveling in Northern Ontario, Cliff and Gloria, played by Eugene Levy and Andrea Martin, who are just looking to have a quiet vacation out of the city. They're kind of a goofy couple. He's a real jerk dud, and she's kind of an airhead. And they come into this town, which has a sort of a storied history of these cannibal women who murdered people passing through. But we are told that they are gone now, but there's a restaurant that stands where they used to live. Please ask no more questions.
But feel free to make reservations for the restaurant.
Yeah, exactly. Let me take you.
Only one thing is on the menu.
Yeah, exactly. They're not very good at being... Though, to be fair, the restaurant is creepy almost immediately. They just can't really leave. They eventually find out, of course, that the restaurant is run by a very strange reverend who seems to have a lot of female followers.
It's also like Father John Misty was a time traveler.
Yes, that same
vibe.
Very, very strange man. And then it's actually, I think the structure is actually kind of interesting because you both see the past in a flashback. You don't realize it's a flashback until it ends. And then you also have this structure where you kind of think you're seeing the whole movie end, but then it sort of starts up again and you're revealing all these unusual aspects of what has gone on with them. But it's lots of, you know, running away from cannibals, trying to get away.
There's lots of parts of this movie that they're just delightful for me. Mm-hmm. And especially because this is a very improvised movie. There was 13 pages of script and then they improvised the rest. And there is a credit here, which I have never seen on anything else, which it says dialogue in collaboration with the actors.
You know, let me tell you, the person who also does it, interestingly, is early George Romero films, because they're the only other filmmaking group that I know did the same thing, where they kind of considered themselves a collective. So Night of the Living Dead has kind of been sorted out now because I think it's so famous. But if you look at the next two George Romero films, which are kind of dramas, Season of the Witch, and I think the other one's called A Taste of Vanilla.
I thought maybe the amusement park.
Amusement park, maybe too.
Yeah,
and it's why some of them kind of fell out of rights, because they, like, I think Ivan Reitman believed that it was a big collaboration, and that necessary, like, taking the big roles was not necessarily, even though these guys obviously did still have the pretty traditional film roles.
This also was a profit share. So, like, nobody got paid until everybody got paid. Although this movie made money,
yeah,
which is
wild. I'm kind of curious, because they don't really, like, they love talking about how much money it cost them, but they don't like talking about how much money they made. And I'm like, I think it's because you made a pretty penny in the end, probably.
Yeah, I always like to think that maybe, like, the origin of Schitt's Creek is that character this film and then bought the rental, like, the rental franchise.
The Jumbo Video. It's mm-hmm. interesting. And I mean, it's like more power to them. But yeah, to know that they, because I think that they said it all, by the end of it all ballooned to about 50 grand. I think they got 50 grand from Arkoff when they sold it. And then he said they had 20% of the gross, which is like, that's good.
Okay, Arkoff. Reitman and his producing partner Goldberg were in the hole for this movie from the very beginning, and their plan was always to get enough money to finish it and then go sell it at the Cannes Marketplace. So they already had an investment from Bellevue Pathé, and they borrowed a bunch of money from family. So Reitman goes to Cannes with a bunch of posters to sell the movie without the print, expecting Goldberg to finish it and then send it with enough time to go through customs and make at least one of the three screening times that the Canadian government had set up for them. So Goldman gets most of the materials to the lab to make the deadline, and then he's called into the offices of Bellevue Pathé, the main investors, who then say, if you don't sign this document that gives us the North American distribution rights, we won't let the lab release the print. And of course, they need those rights to be able to sell the movie at all.
Yeah.
And of course, they know there's a deadline and that Reitman is already in Cannes. What they don't know is that Goldman hasn't delivered two of the 12 reels to the lab yet. So he threatens to drive the negatives off a cliff if they don't release the print. And he is apparently, according to Reitman, like, wild and just like, I have worked on this thing for 2 years of my life. Do not test me. Bellevue Pathé backs down. The print gets to Cannes, where Reitman gets it seen by Arkoff in a screening. He watches it, says, I'll let you know. And then Reitman doesn't hear anything back. So he hunts down Arkoff at his hotel. He gets a meeting, and then they sell the picture for $50,000 up front and 20% of the profit after the break, which is wild, because that's a kind of deal that doesn't happen now.
Yeah, yeah. And the wild thing is it's very much, I mean, Ivan Reitman obviously made a lot of great movies, and we know him for that, but his big break is producing Animal House. So obviously it's like, knowing the comedy people and pulling off this movie is like a big feather in his cap towards the like Lampoon people and the SNL people, which is kind of fascinating.
I think Cannes is, you know, obviously a big part of the story, but whenever I research this film, the other film festival that always comes up is the one in Satige, Spain, which would have been established in the late 60s, like 67. So pretty early in its run, this film played in competition, whereas in Cannes, it's just at the market. It's not in competition. It's for sales. But, you know, Reitman actually submitted this to the Satige Film Festival. I don't know if I'm saying that right.
I think so. Isn't it Satige? I don't know. It's Spanish.
It would be Catalan. Though, yeah. So, I mean, as soon as you, I just, please don't.
I only ever hear Americans saying it, so they all just say Satige.
Yeah, I know. I have been there. It's a lovely place. So you would think I would know how to say it, but yet I do not. But anyway, it won. So it actually, Andrea Martin and Eugene Levy won Best Actress and Best Actor, which, considering how much they kind of troll themselves or their own performances, is sort of lovely. But this is the same film festival that was a launching pad for Cronenberg's, you know, body horror in the 70s as well. Like, Canadian films went to Satige in the 70s and became known worldwide for, you know, just kind of a really unique brand of horror.
And the great story, Alicia, that I think Becky maybe dug up is that he did not know. Apparently it was the Canadian government sent the movies there. And it took him till they were giving him an anniversary award for Ghostbusters. They also trotted out these ancient awards to give to him for, I think it
that
was,
never
yeah, that
up?
He ever picked up for Adrian Martin and Eugene Levy. Because he had no idea that it had won.
That's so interesting.
Because I guess he took off.
Yeah, and, I mean, it kind of makes sense. I think that festival doesn't take off until the mid-70s, specifically with Shivers.
And it seems more powerful than ever, right? Like, it just keeps...
Like, I think this year Lamb won, which is a pretty huge international hit for 2021. If you're ever looking to travel to Spain and have a tax write-off, if you're in the film business, just attend this festival for a few days. That may be exactly what I did. I actually didn't go to the festival. I had a different tax write-off. This is my taxploitation tip for 2022.
I think people who are looking to see the Eugene Levy and the Andrea Martin performances won't be disappointed as much as they lampoon themselves. Eugene Levy has talked about, like, at the time, like, he was fresh out of theater school. It was the first thing he'd done out of theater school. And he's like, at the time, you think you're doing great improvising because you can just keep going. And that does not mean good improvisation. He's actually talked about how he would love to do this again because he would know what to do with the character and how to improvise it. I mean, it'd be a very different story at that point. There's some moments here that are not without charm, which are fully improvised, like watching Andrea Martin talk nicely to their car so it will work is really lovely and really sweet.
Don't be sarcastic.
Oh, I wasn't sarcastic. Wasn't sarcastic.
Go ahead.
It's gonna start, eh?
Go ahead. We love you.
Love you.
She's very charming. I mean, no matter what you say about the performances, I think what I see is her star power in its very nascent stage. I barely recognized Eugene Levy. Like, he's really kind of disguised with this haircut or lack of haircut.
Weird tinted
glasses.
And,
and like a McCabe and Mrs. Miller-esque fur coat.
But that's how it seems like he was old forever is because you couldn't see his face for like half his life. It was obscured by massive facial hair and the afro. Mm-hmm.
And I mean, Reitman says he loves the song he sings was completely improvised. Yeah, I think the thing that's weird, like, I think sitting down to it, if you like Reitman and Martin and Levy, is it's not very funny, but nor is it pushing the humor very hard. Like, it is a light horror movie, is essentially
it's not very violent either,
and it's mostly making fun of like that men are losers. That seems to be like the main joke. The only real existent joke is that, like, look at all these dud beta males falling for it over and over.
What do you do?
I'm in the ice cream business.
He's president of Truck 12.
Okay, Earl, that's enough with the jokes, eh? I got a route, you know, driving a truck.
There was a real element when watching this that kind of harkened back to Let's Scare Jessica to Death, which is, we talked about last season for 1971 and was one of my favorite films of the podcast. This sort of like, you know, there's these female characters who are under the thumb and under control of men. And then these sort of mysterious, ghostly women come in and kind of, you know, shake things up. I think one of the issues with this film is it doesn't know what it is, and that's okay. Yeah. Like, I think the bar should be really low when you judge this film. What's unfortunate is it's just got some of the biggest names in the Canadian film industry. So you expect more, and that does a disservice to it. But I think any fan of horror, any fan trying to understand Canadian cinema, this is an essential text.
Yeah. And I also think that there's a real almost cinematic verve to it, which, again, researching, I figured out is mostly that the original cut was so bad because it had very little horror or gore or scares or kills. So they went back and reshot a bunch of it.
Tons of reshoots.
But those reshoots, that's where I'm like, he's making like a Jess Franco movie because there's like a weird Igor and it's all these dream, because they couldn't match continuity, it's all these dreamy voids where people are being killed. And it's, yeah, it's pretty good. And I think both movies we're going to talk about are kind of gore movies in the end, too. They're kind of Herschel Gordon Lewis-y, because it's people, you know, eating a beef liver covered in red paint sort of situation.
One of the things Arkoff added to this, which we have to talk about, because the poster for this is fantastic. Mm. I would not be ashamed to have this poster up in my bathroom, because it's fantastic. Possibly in my dining room. But it has a thing where they used to play, or they would buzz a bell when things got too sexy or too gory so the squeamish could hide their eyes. It's a very William Castle-y sort of gimmicky sort of thing. But
and that was Arkoff's idea.
This
was
Arkoff's idea, totally. Yeah. But that too is that people would close their eyes and their imagination would tell them it was way gorier and way worse than it was. Right?
It's a great idea, and I wish, I am shocked, and please feel free to steal this, anyone. I would probably suggest Tiff do it. Somebody do that. Give me a screening of Cannibal Girls with the klaxon howl and the ding dong bell that everything's safe. That's cute.
Tiff was involved in, I remember working at Tiff when there was the restoration of this film, which is also partnered with Films We Like, which is one of our friends of Hollywood Suite. We show a lot of their catalog. They're a wonderful distributor. And I remember there was a lot of issues with this film because it had basically turned, the elements had turned pink, essentially, which makes sense for this year, like 73. And then probably given, you know, just how exploitation-y it is and the fact that they're like, this film was held hostage at the lab, I can't imagine much in the way of film preservation occurred in the 70s for this particular, prints that were made, and potentially the negative or inter-negative.
Arkoff is not the film preservationist. He doesn't have the salt mine.
No, but it looks good. It looks good today. Like, make sure, what I would say to listeners is make sure you're watching like a qualified version, and this is streaming. We've had this on Hollywood Suite. It's also currently streaming on Amazon Prime. I don't think it'll ever come off because it's CanCon. Yeah. I think Shudder has had it a time or two. But just make sure you're finding the version that doesn't look blood red, because it's not supposed to look like that.
If anything, I just want all of those women's fashions. You can watch this for the fashion, because I want everything those girls are wearing.
Totally. There's a lot. It has a lot of, like, a real, you know, Russ Meyer lady vibe with all their cool hippie outfits. And I mean, there is gratuitous boobs at the start.
That's kind of what harkened back to Let's Scare Jessica to Death as well. That sort of like yuppie meets hippie, because that's really what's happening, where like the summer of love is over and the hippie culture is morphing into this more corporate entity. And certainly we're going to talk a lot about hatred of hippies with Flesh for Frankenstein, because that is essential to that storyline. But I definitely see by 73 this idea of like, you know, bankers are wearing bell bottoms, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Looking back at Reitman's kind of historical oeuvre, like everything he did, and like as we talked about now, he's known for comedy. I love that he and Dan Goldberg had no pretension whatsoever that they were going to win Oscars. Mm-hmm. Like, that's not what they wanted to do. They just wanted to work in the film industry at any cost. And the cost for them was to do schlock. They were like, that's how we're going to get in. And this kicked the door open for Canadian schlock. Suddenly this put Canada on the market as, hey, the government's going to give you money to make whatever. I mean, we're just kind of starting up right now with government funding for film and having any sort of film industry, and what that would then become with the tax shelter era, which is coming on just like a little bit later. But if you look at a movie like Death Weekend, which I like actually quite a bit. It's like the next level up from this. And then you see Shivers, which he just produced, and things like that. Like, you definitely see someone growing in taste for schlock, if that makes any sense. Like, he's understanding more what people like and how to keep the plot going. And then it's not just like, oh, I have to have someone hit with an axe handle here. It's, okay, this element leads to this element leads to this. And Death Weekend is such a great example of that, because it's, unfortunately, a rape revenge. Brenda Vaccaro is fan-fucking-tastic in it. It's a tasteful rape revenge.
It's
nuanced. It's nuanced.
Becky, a Japanese poster for this film hangs in my home, so I support you in your enjoyment.
What is the other listeners know, what is the other title? Is it House by the Lake?
Yes, the House by the Lake. Yeah. It's a real Last House on the Left ripoff. Yeah.
And like Shivers, which had a different American title, I know that Death Week, I can't remember which one was Canadian, which one was American, but
The House by the Lake is American, and Death Weekend, because Death Weekend is the Japanese title.
It's really good. And, you know, I think what you're kind of alluding to, Becky, is that they figure out how to bring the art house and how to kind of make Canadian cinema world cinema and stop trying to emulate Hollywood. And that's what became very successful.
Yeah. And it's worth saying that Goldberg and Reitman, who are the writers and Reitman directed, they started off in sexploitation with films that are essentially lost. The Columbus of Sex and Foxy Lady.
The Columbus of Sex was the one they almost got, well, that Ivan Reitman almost got deported for the first time.
And those are the ones, I believe, that they just made, they produced and like did cinematography and stuff. They didn't direct or write, unless the person's a total pseudonym, I don't know. But, oh, it might be. Yeah, so it's kind of interesting because you can see that they were seeing that sort of maple syrup porn not be the angle for them and not lead anywhere. And I mean, it's also very interesting when we talk about, like, this made his career. 1973 to 1978, I believe, is Animal House. That's a big chunk. So he's still working for it. It still was a climb. And it's just cool to see a guy. Ivan Reitman, it's kind of weird because he has great movies, but you kind of don't give him credit because he works with great performers, unfortunately. So I think that they tend to take most of the credit. But to know that he still talks fondly about this movie, even though he doesn't necessarily say it's good, it has a charming attitude about it.
But he, unlike many producers, although he made the leap to director, he's a household name. Like, if you say Ivan Reitman to a lot of people, they will know.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. And I mean, I rudely put on my letterbox that I think that this is his most visually interesting film, but I do think that, like,
that is so mean,
but I mean, it's cause it's got crazy shots in it. He's doing crazy stuff with the visual language. Yeah. Like, normally he's kind of a put the camera down guy, but I mean, also, like, I can admit, sure, he invented crazy special effects for Ghostbusters, but I think that some of the ways this is shot is wild. But yeah, he's it's easy to take him down a peg, but he does have, it's because he has many classic movies and is richer than God and buys and sells any Canadian that he wants.
All right, on that note, let's head over to Europe for our next film, for something that I don't know if the filmmaker is necessarily lauded at this point, but they definitely have a place in cinematic history. We're going to be looking at Andy Warhol's, or is it, Flesh for Frankenstein. That's coming up after the break.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Bananas, Campbell's soup cans, platinum pageboy haircut. Is that what pops up in your mind when I say the name Andy Warhol? How about plentiful nudity and taboo sex? Internal organs? So many internal organs. Well, today we're going to be looking at a movie that is called Andy Warhol's Flesh for Frankenstein. But is it really Andy Warhol's? Let's get into this deeply bizarre movie, which I saw for the first time at 14, and I really, really shouldn't have. This is not a movie for 14-year-olds without, like, extended context. Mm-hmm. Alicia, do you want to give us a plot summary on this one? It's Frankenstein, but it's not.
Sure. I mean, I would argue that this is basically the sexual fantasies of a 14-year-old.
Yeah, I was going to say, don't tell 14-year-olds to watch this.
Like, this is not a mature, sexy film.
No.
This is what 14-year-olds might think sex is. Yeah. So, yes, it's very loosely based on Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. I would say a lot looser than the Kenneth Branagh version that we discussed a few seasons ago. And, you know, we have Baron von Frankenstein, who is played by a very young, in one of his, you know, earliest roles, Udo Kier. And he is married to his sister wife, sometimes refers to as his sister, sometimes his wife. They have two children. And as, you know, the scientist, he's trying to create this super race that he's referring to, kind of the perfect Serbian race, because he feels that the human race has been degraded. And he's, you know, he's found some people. He's swapping body parts. He cuts the head off one guy, puts it on another dude's body, does the same thing with a woman. And he's going to have them, you know, mate. And they're going to, you know, populate this super race. So there's some zombieism here in a way, like the actual zombie canon kind of being added to Mary Shelley's story in a way that's not there in the original text. And meanwhile, you know, there's this really hot farmhand who has a very thick Brooklyn accent, which doesn't entirely...
arguably the best grasp of English of anyone in the entire movie. It's a real balancing act. Do you want the correct accents or do you want somebody who speaks English?
I would
English?
Say that's not arguable. Yeah. That's true.
My favorite's when he tells the guy who wants to be the priest who becomes the monster. He's like, we grew up together. And the other guy's got like the thickest
Austrian accent. Yeah.
It's so funny.
And, you know, that farmhand is played by Joe D'Alessandro, who I cannot wait to talk about because he's an icon of so many different things. queer culture of, you know, the Warhol Factory, of experimental film, of John Waters, of all kinds of things. But this farmhand kind of like notices, like he finds his friend's body missing a head and he figures something's up. He gets enmeshed with the sister wife because she's hot to trot, and Udo Kier, let's just say, which is also her brother, is not pleasing her in the bedroom. So she brings him in as her like manservant. He then like he's like serving mutton to the crew and realizes like, that's weird. That's my friend, but he's a lot taller because his head is on a different body. And it goes
there
from
are great
there.
Moments like that. Like
it's really funny.
You're the butler to your own dead friend's head on another corpse.
Yes. And he's taller. I really actually love this film. I think like you, Becky, I can't say I was 14 years old, but I was too young for it, certainly. And I would say also didn't have a really robust knowledge at the time of factory filmmaking and Paul Morrissey's practice and how Andy Warhol's brand, you know, existed in the film world. So I was just really ignorant. But it is, if you like schlock, if you like to laugh, like this is a comedy.
Yeah.
And I think regardless of what Paul Morrissey says today, and let me tell you want to be entertained, just pull up an interview in the last 10 years with this fucking madman.
Grumpy.
A guy
there's
who
grumpy
just like,
and then there's abusive.
He's abusive. What are you talking about?
Yeah.
Also,
I
want you, Alicia, to let yourself off the hook for being ignorant of the factory's films as a teen in the 90s. I think you're allowed.
You know, Warhol has made a series of films, a lot of experimenting with Edie Sedgwick, with, you know, Cookie Mueller, with, Candy Darling. I could go on and on. Joe D'Alessandro, certainly. And he ends up making three films through Paul Morrissey, one of which is really famous, called Flesh, which features Joe D'Alessandro as a hustler. These are really Paul Morrissey films. Like, if we think of sort of Warhol as an atelier. However, Warhol's name going on them was marketing. And so when it comes to 1970, I believe this is filmed in 72, the crowd kind of, you know, the factory crowd gets rounded up and they go to Italy because they're going to make a film through Carlo Ponti, who at that time was probably married to Sophia Loren. Mm-hmm. Anyway, big time Italian producer. Something goes awry, and I think Carlo Ponti's involvement is very minimal, if not negligible and maybe non-existent, even though it's on the Wikipedia page. And they decide they're just going to make Frankenstein. They're going to make Blood for Dracula, which is the next year. They kind of film them back to back. It's the same sets. It's some of the same costumes. It's the same crew. Paul Morrissey meets, I can't remember if it's Paul Morrissey or the producer, meets Udo Kier on an
airplane. I think Paul Morrissey,
I think it's Morrissey, and he's just like, you're my,
that's
you know.
But he's so beautiful at that time.
Yeah, he's so beautiful. And one of my favorite Warhol Polaroids of all time is, you know, the one time Warhol came to set, which really was once, on Blood for Dracula, and he took this great photograph. Just Google it. Udo Kier, Andy Warhol Polaroid, because it's the Blood for Dracula makeup with the fangs, but he's in street clothes, and it's a great shot.
Was that the one where he's in plaid?
Yeah, and, like, trousers,
Amazing.
You know, Warhol's very minimally involved. He showed up, he shot some photographs, he went home.
Can we also just say, that I just want to interject just for 1 second, the reason why he was so hands-off with filmmaking at this point was because of Valerie Solanas shooting him.
I was going to say...
There's some people who say that, but I mean that's fair. You could say that he's hands-off on a lot of things because he's recovering from attempted murder. I also think at a certain point that if you look at his art practice, though, the brand...
He's just hands-off on everything, kind of.
Yeah, because that was coming before the shooting, for sure. I think
the films especially, there's like the experimental era where you can tell he made them, and then from then on, the films are other people.
Yeah, and if you believe Paul Morrissey, he claims that he basically taught Warhol how to use a camera, how to use lighting, how to use rapid exposure, how to use double exposure, if not quadruple exposure, how to do, like, it's really, the mise-en-scène is coming from Paul Morrissey, if we are to believe Paul Morrissey, but there's quite a bit backing that up.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was crazy as the idea of putting Andy Warhol's name on a film like this, which is much more akin with Cannibal Girls, although it's far more polished than something like, you know, Chelsea Girls or, you know, the 24-hour films that Andy Warhol's making and projecting at MoMA. Like, it's such a different practice.
As much as I think that sometimes the who did what is contentious, for these two films, we know pretty clearly, partially because in Italy they tried to claim that Antonio Margheriti did a lot of work on them, and they were successfully sued for lying by, I think, the Italian government. It was a very weird thing.
Putting that guy's name on there would have been the equivalent of putting a Canadian producer
to get money,
on there,
right?
And then it's like, okay, here's all your tax dollars.
So they essentially legally proved that Paul Morrissey did everything, and Udo is the first person to say it too, that like, you didn't see anybody else around. And I mean, it sounds like a weird system. Once again, we're talking about a film that is not quite improvised, but written the day before on a legal pad. And I think you can really tell that it's been a minute since I've seen Blood for Dracula, I will say, but I think you can tell that Blood for Dracula was a bit more thought out, and especially in Udo's performance, because I don't think he's bad at speaking English necessarily. I think you're handing somebody whose English is a second language his lines right before it's shot, and he's struggling a bit with the actual lines.
And Becky, could you tell us what your favorite line from Flesh for Frankenstein is? Because I saw it in your notes, and I was like, oh good, we both have the same favorite line.
You know what? It's not just me, because all over the internet, this is the one people quote, because it is,
to know death, Otto, you have to fuck life in the gallbladder.
I don't know what to do with that.
It's like, delivered. It's delivered like Shakespeare by Udo Kier. Line, like, it's really wonderful.
I will say that my favorite is that he says that they need to find a man who responds to women's filthy movements and dirty talk. he's disgusted by women with large breasts, which he's so good.
We talk about Joe D'Alessandro, who is openly bisexual, you know, has multiple marriages. He's such a queer icon and someone who supported the gay community throughout the late 60s into the 70s and 80s. But Udo Kier is an interesting figure. And I would really encourage people to see the film from 2021, Swan Song, which is sort of Udo Kier's, you know, late career, I don't want to say comeback, because he's never gone anywhere, but it gives him the sort of dramatic role that he deserves. And it's not the best film, but I was riveted by Udo Kier as
good
this
role
kind of aging.
Him.
This aging gay man who breaks out of the nursing home to do, he's a hairstylist. It's quite good. But he's really a gay icon, I think, Udo Kier. He was openly gay, but it was never really commented on. And I think you see it so much here in Flesh for Frankenstein, more so than Blood for Dracula, where he is openly disgusted by women. And it works so well in a Frankenstein storyline.
Camp elements. I will say, I there's somebody in the New York Times said that it drags more than it camps. And I kind of agree with that. But I think that the camp moments are definitely how gay him and his little Igor seem, and how obviously gay the friend is for Joe D'Alessandro. Like, they're in a like orgy, and he just keeps cutting to him looking at him. I love that you said that it was like a 14-year-old's version of sex, because this is the movie that will also make you go, does Joe D'Alessandro know how to have sex? Like,
it's
the
worst,
least sexy sex scenes, and there's like slurping sounds. It's so
just
weird.
Because Joe D'Alessandro is on the cover of, so it's his crotch on the cover of the very infamous Sticky Fingers album by the Rolling Stones. That is his crotch bulge.
Yeah.
And, you know, he had been photographed by Richard Avedon. Like, he is, he started as a male model at like 15 or 16 after running away from home.
Yeah.
And ends up at the factory.
After running away from jail. Is the best. He was at a youth reformatory and he ran away.
He has a tough upbringing. There's like a foster home. Yeah. His mother was imprisoned when he was very young.
I mean, I love he got
his mother was like 15 when she had him, I think.
Dropped out of school when he punched the principal, which is a great one. The principal
okay,
was
can someone
mocking
make a biopic
his father
here,
and he punched him. Yeah, there's a lot of grim stuff in there, but if you pick the highlights, he's got a real, real interesting life.
And I love that this was 3D. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was mostly shown in 3D in 73. It's really the tail end of like where 3D was even marketable.
Yeah.
But it lasted a lot longer in Europe, 3D, as well as 70 millimeter and those sort of roadshow formats. But like when I was watching this, I was trying to picture like what would the main 3D effects be? And it was really just like every time someone is disemboweled,
yeah.
It's like their organs are thrown at the center of the screen.
To go back to our previous film, what you need to know about the 3D is it's 100% the Dr. Tongue stuff from SCTV, where like the whole movie screeches to a halt and somebody goes, because
the end sequence of this film is almost to me like a ballet composed by Stravinsky.
Mm.
I could not believe how, and I don't want to spoil for you, let's just say some people die.
Yeah.
And they die grotesquely.
Quote unquote.
But the way that it's choreographed and how Baron von Frankenstein dies, and, you know, let's just say maybe a 20-foot pole's involved. I'm not sure.
It's great. Great 3D,
I don't want
to
spoil.
Be honest.
So good in 3D. Yeah. And we should give a big shout out to Carlo Rambaldi. Mm. And this is an early film of his. He was, you know, very much based in the Italian film industry at this point. But he built the creatures for E.T. Mm. He worked on Alien. He built the creature for Possession, which is very scary and reminded me a lot of this film. The Conan films, the 70s King Kong. Like, he is a master. And I think a lot of the special effects in this, like the beating hearts and all the organs, they don't look like a B film. They look
good. Look,
no, my favorite little detail is when the head is decapitated, the eyes are still moving. I was like, that's
the
wild.
Eyes are still
you
moving, and it's
that.
Constantly gushing a torrent of blood, which I think are, you're right. Wonderful effects. And like, I think like the unfortunate thing is I just wish, because it's kind of like Paul Morrissey and this crew got two cracks of like commercial movies, and I prefer, I guess, Blood for Dracula. So this one, I don't know, just kind of, I don't know.
I like
it doesn't hit quite right for me. But there are moments, like Joe D'Alessandro visibly sighing and turning around with a lizard that was on his butt to show it to the camera to make it 3D for a second. It's
yeah, that was pretty good. I mean, I think you hit it spot on, Cam, is because these films are so back to back. It's just more polished, Blood for Dracula. And I think Udo Kier is a bit more comfortable in his skin in this sort of format of a film. But I think this still has enormous. It's such an interesting phrase.
It's not a bad story, for sure. And I also, it really reminds me of Italian horror comics, which tend to end in a very similar imagery. I won't spoil what happens, but it tends to be like,
I love it.
You don't get a happy ending in an Italian horror comic. I also wanted to point out, when you're like, this is a good version of Frankenstein, this is a weird mini Frankenstein boom for kind of unknown reasons. People just got into Frankenstein because there's the similar but even less plot heavy Jess Franco Erotic Rites of Frankenstein is this year. Blackenstein is this year. There's...
May I make a suggestion for why? If Frankenstein's published in 1832, then it's... Okay, no, that doesn't make sense. I was going to say it's 150th, but it's not. There could be a public domain
situation. Yeah, maybe. I do wonder, because it's like, there's a Michael Sarrazin one where Frankenstein is handsome and then turns into a monster.
I love Michael Sarrazin.
Your Rankin and Bass Mad Monsters is around this time. Young Frankenstein is next year.
Love it.
Spirit of the Beehive.
This has to be a public domain thing.
Yeah.
This has to be a public domain
thing. It might be. Or,
there's no
or
way.
What, maybe is there? Could there be a rights thing with the old movies at this point?
30, so like the Universal
one?
Yeah,
I don't know. Because, like, Spirit of the Beehive has that Frankenstein, you know, like a Boris Karloff.
It does, yeah.
I don't know. Anyway, it's just I can't quite explain it, but I just like, because I was like, when was Erotic Rites of Frankenstein, which has kind of a similar Nazi eugenicist Frankenstein, who's like a sadist. Yeah, and it's right around here. And same with even Hammer.
Speaking of which, Nazis, I was reminded a little bit of Ilsa She-Wolf of the SS.
Sure.
There's a bit of that. For sure.
You know, still our top performing episode of all time. No surprises there. But I was really drawn to sort of the Catholic imagery in this film, and knowing that Paul Morrissey, who is by his own description today, as well as in the 70s, extremely conservative, potentially bigoted, and a devout Catholic, kind of reminded me of Ken Russell in that way, when we talked about The Devils, among other Ken Russell films, Litzomania as well. But there's a lot of just like, I almost wonder if he was looking at Catholic paintings and sort of animating them.
Yeah, definitely that last tableau.
And it works really well with, if you think about like these paintings from the 15th century, the 16th century, they are bloody. There are weird organs. Like, it's just so strange. Like, it's very what we consider surreal.
The choices for me of when to show nudity versus when to not is really interesting to me. It's like, you don't mind cutting up all these bodies, and we're going to see Joe D'Alessandro's penis, but you're not showing us any of these other young men. You've taken the time to carefully tape these like little clothy and things across them is interesting to me. Why are you showing me this but not this?
I think this movie, considering I think it's hard to read something like flesh suiting his weird interest and saying it's spoofing. But this one is like borderline a comedy of errors about two incredibly horny people, horny for a very specific purpose, goofing around, getting the head of a monk, then accidentally bringing in the horny guy who's his friend. Like, it's kind of a comedy of errors, and like they die in very dumb ways because they're just cruel. And I mean, the other thing that's weird is like them constantly fawning over these children, which, spoiler, are bad seed, evil weirdos.
Yeah, what is going on with 70s and children?
They love it. They love to be like, the kids are much worse than we are. Yeah.
I think baby boomers became parents, and baby boomers, I would say, are the worst generation. I'm going to get red for that potentially, but I don't know. My parents were baby boomers. And I think they're just like grappling with like raising kids and the responsibilities, because there's that free love summer and like, you know, everyone's pregnant, and then it's like, oh shit,
now we have now we all have bad children. Interesting. I mean bad kids are around pretty much from the dawn of cinema, you're right that these kind of, especially like silent Muppets,
Insidious,
that are just...
I was even thinking about Who's Lou
Anti-Roo. It's very Who's Lou Anti-Roo.
The Omen,
kind of like beautiful standing there, and you're like, and I mean, it's telegraphed from the beginning what they're like. So yeah, it's a very
the seeds
weird...
of Clifford are sown yes. in flesh for Frankenstein.
Yeah, if they only let Clifford be in a old timey castle, maybe a
first
sequel.
Clifford reference of the season. Yeah. Let's mark it.
Episode one.
To go with the Joe D'Alessandro stories, I love that Udo Kier was born and then the hospital was bombed and then his mother dug out of the rubble with him as a baby.
After he was born.
She literally was like, can I have a moment with my baby? And the bomb hit the hospital, so there's nobody with them. Brutal, but also wonderful to his weird character, you know?
I love Udo Kier. He's a international treasure.
We should also say there is a music video for Madonna called For Deeper and Deeper where he's in it. So is Joe D'Alessandro, like a bunch of the Warhol folk who were still around at that point are all in it, which is kind of nice to see.
Udo, the interesting thing to say, which kind of goes into the future, is also like this makes him sort of iconic, you know, this is an English language crossover, and yet it kind of takes the reminiscing about the factory in the early 90s with people like Gus Van Sant and like Lars von Trier,
Mary Harron,
to bring him back, to make him what we know now. He makes mostly European movies between this and the 90s, basically.
He also would go on, I think, more so because of Blood for Dracula, playing vampires. Mm. I mean, even into like something like Shadow the Vampire, where I realize he's not playing a vampire.
But he's there. You know why he's there. Yeah.
He's also got that like ethereal beauty.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Like, that we attribute to Dracula.
And he's always got that, a cold man, weirdly, in spite of the fact that he seems very warm and silly when you see him talk, you know? And I will say it's very worth digging into just about everyone in this movie, because like Dahlia De Lazzaro, who just plays the lady monster, she like went on to a lot of exploitation stuff. People thought she was, I think, Sophia Loren's secret sister. Very interesting. Monique Van Voren, who plays the Baroness, mm-hmm. was like a Belgian actress but lived in New York. And then she also, like, there's a lot of interesting legal issues with her later in life, and this is mm-hmm. one of her last roles, but she continued to live. She just stopped acting, which is kind of wild. I guess she might have been on Broadway. I don't know. It's an interesting film to like dig deep into.
I think the casting, to Paul Morrissey's credit, because he almost exclusively cast this film, is an act of genius. And you know, given how many of these people would not have been well known to North American audiences, he pulls it off really, really well. And I do think, for all the bad that Paul Morrissey has, you know, revealed in his interviews, he really respects actors, which I find is unusual, right? Usually asshole directors think of actors as sheep or dogs or cattle, and Paul Morrissey, he's there for the Udo Kier performances.
He was also trying to facilitate things. Like, one of the reasons he had to write the script out was this was supposed to all be improvised, but the European actors couldn't do it in English, and it was just they just weren't quick enough. So, you know, that's why he was at every single night, okay, I'm gonna write you a page, here's the next page
and
of
I
the
think,
story, right?
Again, like Cannibal Girls, when you hear all these things, you're like, you know what, you pulled it off pretty good. Like,
Plus, you didn't do a bad job.
And again, it's like Udo. If Udo did not go on to be who Udo is, you might be like, why the hell did you cast this guy that didn't speak good English other than what he looks like? But
I think he's perfect in this.
I don't know.
He's got star quality. Udo Kier is a star.
He's got star quality. He just can't say the lines.
He looks like a young Nijinsky.
Sure.
There's a real like ballet quality.
Well, I'll watch him dubbed in Mark of the Devil, starring Herbert Lom, his other film from around then.
You enjoy that.
I'm also going to make the point that Schwarzenegger's English was not fantastic when they started putting him in film, but there's always something.
Or they had him not talk like Robert Altman, so, you know.
Punching a camel.
All right, I think that's where we should leave this one. So, Cameron Maitland, thank you once again for joining us. Welcome to season 4.
Oh, yeah. I'm so excited. The only other shout-out I wanted to give is I forgot to say that fans of the Hilarious House of Frightenstein will enjoy that Fishka Ray Igor briefly appears in Cannibal Girls, which is cute.
Oh, I love it. We're going to have to, I've always wanted to do a podcast about, because there's so many great stories about Hilarious House of Dr. Frightenstein that I need to do a full podcast just on it a season. I'll see if the CBC wants to do it. It'll be great. And Alicia Fletcher, thank you so much once again. It's going to be a good season.
I'm very excited for the season. I would like to give a shout out to my friend Hemet, who is the same person that handed out all the Eyes of Laura Mars DVDs as calling cards. He gifted me, like, the year later, a full set of original Flesh for Frankenstein lobby cards.
Ooh, that would be
good.
Beautiful, because when I was doing the, like, research, I was like, God damn, those are Andy Warhol photographs. Like, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, that's not bad.
So I have, like, 12, the full set of in all their glory. So I really should get them framed.
Put us in your will, Alicia.
Pass it along. Are you making threats right now?
No, just in case. You guys could be in my will. I just don't have anything good.
Okay. All right. And you can join us in 2 weeks, where we're going to be looking at two very rock and roll versions of, is it the greatest story ever told or the second greatest,
it's the greatest story ever told?
If his birth is the greatest story ever told, oh, is his death
the New Testament?
We're looking at Christ Superstar and Godspell.
It's the Bible. I believe that's the greatest story ever told, is the entire Bible.
I wasn't totally clear. This is going to be great. And we're going to be joined by Anthony Oliveira, the dumpster raccoon himself. That's coming up in a couple weeks. Thanks for joining us for this episode of the A Year in Film podcast from Hollywood Suite. If you enjoyed the show, please remember to rate and review us on your podcast platform. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, at Hollywood Suite. Hollywood Suite is the home of the movies and the series that shaped the 70s, 80s, 90s, and 2000s. Always uncut and always commercial free.
Hollywood Suite lets you experience movies the way they were meant to be seen. On 4 HD channels and Hollywood Suite on demand. Subscribe today at hollywoodsuite.ca. The A Year in Film podcast is hosted by Becky Shrimpton and produced by Becky Shrimpton, Alicia Fletcher, and Cameron Maitland. And today featured Cameron Maitland and Alicia Fletcher as guests. Supervising producer is Emily Gagné. Executive producers are David Kynes and Julie Kumaria. Audio engineering by Andy Reid. We'll see you in a couple weeks.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.